isometric mid-thigh-pull is wonderful for testing strength, but there's literally a 2% relationship with changes in dynamic strength and isometric mid-thigh-pull strength. So I can get much, much stronger in the back squat, the deadlift, and it doesn't actually associate with changes in isometric mid-thigh-pull performance. But we've still got coaches going, oh, I'm testing isometric mid-thigh-pull, even though they're using dynamic strength, not isometric strength, in their actual performance. So whatever it is that they're testing, they're sure as hell not testing what they think they're testing.
Hi, Jonathan. It's my pleasure to have you on Evidence Strong Show. If you could briefly introduce yourself, that would be awesome.
Okay, so my name is Jonathan Weekly. I am originally from New Zealand, from the South, not the Deep South, although I did go down to the Deep South to do my undergraduate in sports and exercise nutrition. I then went over to Wollongong and did my master's in clinical nutrition. And at that same time, I thought, let's really spice it up and do another master's at the same time. And I did a second master's at Edith Cowan University, where I studying. And then I was really fortunate to meet my supervisors, Professor Ben Jones and Professor Kevin Till, about 10 years ago. It's a little bit, maybe even a little bit longer. And I did my PhD there with the England Rugby Union and Leeds Beckett. I did my fellowship over in the north of England. And then after about 5 or 6 years there, I decided to come back and come back to Australian Catholic University, now being based in sunny old Queensland.
Whoa. So you went from cold to reasonably warm.
I think like every Kiwi, we all want to kind of escape the cold and end up in Southeast Queensland. I swear everyone over here is, we're all related. We're all Kiwis over here in Southeast Queensland. And that was the goal.
The topic of today is testing and profiling athletes. You are an expert, so let's jump straight into it and tell me why we should be testing or caring about testing and profiling athletes.
That's a good question. But I think first and foremost, the reason why we test is because if we don't know where we've come from, we don't know where we're going. So we're without testing and profiling of our athletes, we're essentially rudderless. And then fundamentally underpinning testing is the concepts of being able to prescribe from them. So if we can test using tests, we can prescribe subsequent training. We can then monitor them. So I always say that if our athletes are improving, we want to share with everyone far and wide that our training programs are working, because that's what keeps us in the job. So we need to be able to demonstrate proof to coaches that they are getting stronger or faster or jumping higher or whatever tests that we may be running. We want to be able to prove it. And then the last reason is a little bit of kind of a conceptual one, which is ranking our athletes. So if all of our athletes are held constant, so let's say you and me are both training to be selected in a squad of athletes or a starting position, let's say in rugby union, we want to be a winger. Well, we know that if everything is held constant, so we were the same height, same skill level, same fitness level, same strength, is this physical quality going to be the characteristic which is going to determine our selection? So let's say for a winger, you need to be really fast. We know that because speed helps us evade our competitors. So the thing is that if everything is held constant, but I'm faster than you, I should be select, because that's a fundamental characteristic which is important for that sport. So it helps us rank our athletes. So that's why we select those tests, are helping to differentiate selection decisions as well. So prescription, monitoring, and ranking our athletes are the three things that we need to be thinking about of why we test.
So how do we decide which tests we should use with this particular athlete or this particular team?
Prescription. Can you prescribe with it? Can you use that information to train a physiological quality? A 1RM back squat is great because I can go train at 70% of your 1RM back squat. That allows us to prescribe from it, and we know that we're improving the physiological quality that we want, i.e. dynamic strength. Monitoring. This is a reliable test. The 30-15, if we improve by one level, we are having a improvement in physiological capacity, which is associated with their VO2. That then allows us to go, their VO2 has increased.
Could you just stop for a second, and could you explain what reliability is? So what does it mean that the test is reliable?
Yes, and there's multiple forms of reliable, but reliability essentially is the ability to form. You can have, let me put it like this, you can have varying levels of reliability or reproducibility. It's, can you reliably reproduce physical performance across two testing or time points? So for example, if you jump 40 centimeters on a force plate, the next day you might jump 39.5. And the day after that, you might jump 40.5. Now, you haven't gone worse or better across those days. That's just normal noise. noise, and understanding that there's normal variance and changes in performance across time is something that we need to come to grips with. And you need to be able to account for that. So every test has your error or variance, and understanding how that variance affects our test so that we can decipher or cut away that noise and actually just hear the signal. So every test has noise, every test has signal. Is that signal greater than that noise?
All right, now validity. That's a bigger topic, I think, but if we could go through some of the concepts we should be considering when we're thinking whether the test is valid.
Yeah, sure. So validity is, as you said, is a big, huge construct, actually. Validity is kind of like, is it measuring what you think you're measuring? And every test has issues with validity, and there's kind of like two domains of validity. You have test validity and methodological validity. But if we just kind of focus on that testing validity for a moment, you know, every test tends to use technology nowadays. So what is the accuracy of that test? Of that technology. So the thing is that if I jump 40 centimeters on the force plate and the force plate is telling me that I'm jumping 50 centimeters or 30 centimeters, well, that's not my fault as the athlete. That's the technology's error. So is that technology accurately telling you what you think it's telling you? Okay, the next thing would be, you know, construct validity. So construct validity would be, are you measuring what you actually think you're measuring? So let's use something like the vertex. You know, athletes jump and they jump into the air and then they hit those little arms on the little vertex thing and they say, oh, I jump, you know, 40 centimeters. The issue is that they didn't jump 40 centimeters, they jump and reached 40 centimeters, and that has a skill component. And the skill component actually mitigates your ability to say that athlete is jumping this high, because I can train an athlete for a day and put several inches on an individual's jump performance. They haven't improved their jump performance by several inches, not at all. They've just gone better at climbing, hitting those little arms or veins on the vertex. They've got maybe some skill element added into that jump. So all of a sudden, we're no longer testing jump height, we're testing jump and reach height. And that's a very, very different construct. And we need to be able to understand that and decipher that. So another example could be isometric mid-thigh-pull. People go, oh, isometric mid-thigh-pull, it's wonderful for testing strength. But there's literally a 2% relationship with changes in dynamic strength and isometric mid-thigh-pull strength. So I can get much, much stronger in the back squat, the deadlift, and it doesn't actually associate with changes in isometric mid-thigh-pull performance. But we've still got coaches going, oh, I'm testing isometric mid-thigh-pull, even though they're using dynamic strength, not isometric strength, in their actual performance. So whatever it is that they're testing, they're sure as hell not testing what they think they're testing. Another example could be the yo-yo test. It's not high-end, it's not VO2, it's not an assessment of aerobic capacities and an assessment of high-intensity running performance. And understanding and deciphering those things and knowing what you think you're knowing is really, really important. Another example of validity could be using standardization to ensure that we're testing apples, comparing apples to apples, not apples and bananas. So I think if we're going to be honest, let's say you had a squad of athletes, I can almost guarantee I could probably shave about half a second off their, you know, 10-meter time. You know, just remember that a 10-meter time is somewhere in the vicinity of 1 to 1.5 seconds. So if I take your athletes down to 1.5, down to 1 second, I've had a 33% improvement in their 10-meter performance. Now, I'm not that good a coach. I'll be honest, I'm not a great sprint coach. I know about sprinting. So what did I do? Well, essentially, all I need to do is just move them 50 centimeters back from the start gate. So essentially, we're no longer carrying two athletes when one's starting on the line and one's starting 50 centimeters back. And we've all done testing in sprint testing where athletes are lined up and they're ready to go. And one athlete rocks and rolls into it. One athlete starts 50 centimeters back, one athlete starts 30 centimeters back, and one athlete starts right on the line. Well, actually, the noise associated with that standardization essentially means that the test is now worthless because we can't decipher between those athletes because the standardization isn't right. And that's an issue with validity. And understanding those sorts of concepts of what is it that we are testing and are we accurately testing it is essential for our tests that we select, because that allows us to better understand our athletes and accurately represent the physiological qualities that we want to test. I remember when I still do it when I'm working with athletes, maybe I'm just a grumpy old man nowadays, I'm not sure, but like I'm shouting out, I'm kind of saying, don't lie to me, because I don't care if they're good or bad. I can work with good or bad athletes. I just don't want athletes to be quarter squatting when they say they're going to do full squat. I don't want athletes to be misrepresenting their sprint speed or jump height by using some sort of poor standardization process, because I can't work with that, because I can't decipher that signal from the noise there. So, you know, all I want to know is where that athlete is, because then I can improve that. I can make them better from that. And that's all about validity. And validity and reliability aren't sexy kind of topics, are they? You know, no one's kind of gearing up for a big lecture on validity and reliability when it comes to first year, you know, research methods, but it's really important. And if you don't understand that as an S&C coach, you need to stop. You need to step away from whatever it is that you're doing. You need to go learn about it and then come back to what you're doing, because you can't be an S&C coach or a science sports scientist if you don't understand these basic qualities.
All right, one more sensitivity.
Yeah, and this is essentially the ability to decipher the signal from the noise. So if you've got really large noise or issues with regarding reliability, let's say the error of the test is 10 centimeters for a counter movement jump. So I jumped 40 centimeters, but I could have jumped 50 centimeters, or I could have jumped 30 centimeters. Well, that's a problem, because the smallest worthwhile change, or a change which is worthwhile for most athletes, is about 2 centimeters, or really 1 to 2 centimeters. So I could have improved by 1 or 2 centimeters, but the error of the test is so big that we cannot, you know, we cannot detect that change. It's not sensitive, as the test is not sensitive. Another example, a really good example of that is rate of force development. Man, people love rate of force development. Theoretically, it's a cool concept, because if you produce more force in a short period of time, going by basic physics, you will perform better, often with sprinting and jumping and those sorts of things. Rate of force development, when you start to dig into it, is just 2 points and a line between it. It's the slope of a line. Like, once you start to dig into that, you kind of realize it's a made up metric and it's not really reliable, particularly in things like the isometric mid-thigh pull. And for the life of me, I can only see 1 or 2 labs who have reliably been able to measure that. So I'm always kind of got my eyebrows up when I read those people's work. But the thing is when we see those tests like RFD, rate of force development, at 50 milliseconds or 100 milliseconds, 150 milliseconds, and we know the error of the test is something like, we did a reliability study of that test recently. It was like 75%.
Yeah.
So I know I need to improve my physical qualities by about 150% to be able to detect the change. And I sure as hell ain't going to be improving my performance by 150%. It's physiologically really impossible. So the thing is that things like RFD and the isometric mid-thigh pull are just not sensitive tests. You cannot convince me, no matter, and hundreds of labs around the world, that RFD from the isometric mid-thigh pull can be, you know, sensitively sensitive test of physical performance. Theoretically, it's an interesting test, but is it a sensitive test? And that's the real issue, because we need to be able to tell our coaches, are we improving? I don't think you can with tests like that. And that's an issue with sensitivity, and that's underpinned by reliability.
Okay, on that, in the paper, we kind of discussing, so we base this discussion on, you have an awesome table with some of the tests listed with a coefficient of variation and a reference. So maybe if someone is interested to know exactly whether the tests they are already using or are thinking about using, we may send them to the table. It's table 3. All right, very important question. We decided we want to test. We know what qualities or capabilities we want to test. We chose the test, let's say, correctly. Now, what we should consider while implementing the test, or a battery of that matter.
What should we consider?
Yeah, in terms of, does the order matter, and are there sneaky ways we could put the testing in so we are not obviously testing athletes again and again and again? Because we all know that athletes are not fans of testing.
Yeah, there are a range of ways that we can test and we can go about it. And then that's often underpinned by a good understanding of technology and physiology and biomechanics. And if you can kind of pin those last three things, physiology, technology, biomechanics, and all those other things like validity and sensitivity, you can kind of do some really fancy things as well.
Okay, should we go into order of testing?
Yeah, sure. So what order we should test?
Yes.
And the easy answer to that is, do the stuff that's easiest first. So is things like anthropometry and assessment of body composition going to absolutely gas you? No. So things like body composition, we need to understand the body composition of our athletes. And we might use the DEXA or skin calipers. Now, I've done a lot of DEXAs and a lot of skin calipers and used the skin calipers a lot in my career. And I have never seen an athlete being absolutely gassed after lying down for 10 minutes. Yeah. So the thing is that we'd probably put those tests first. And on top of that, the reason we'd also put them first is because we need to use proper standardized processes for that. So if we've got them overly hydrated, or we've given them a lot of food beforehand for those tests, we might have inaccurate testing, game validity. And then we kind of go down to basic tests, which are really simple. So it might be assessment of power. Now, assessment of power is often very quick and very fast and very efficient. So a counter movement jump. Now, I've worked with a lot of athletes again, but the thing is, I've never seen an athlete go, I've done my one jump for today and that's it, I'm going home. I've never seen it. And it doesn't. The reason is because a jump might be half a second, and most athletes have the capacity more than half a second. So the thing is then those sorts of tests might go first. So, you know, you do anthropometry and body composition into tests of power. And then you might go into tests such as sprint performance. Now, all maximal sprint speed. Those tests are essentially tests where you can get them done in about 4 seconds. So 40 meters sprint might be five or so seconds. Most athletes can recover from that and then still carry on with their day. So then we'll go, okay, maybe sprinting is the next assessment. And then we kind of start getting into tests that might be more physiologically demanding. So that might be a maximal strength test. So maximal back squat. So 1RM back squats or bench presses or pull-ups or whatever it is testing that you can do. Remember, as long as it's valid and reliable, I don't and sensitive. But the thing is that those strength tests would then probably follow that test of maximum sprint speed. The next thing might be a maximal aerobic test or a test to exhaustion. And that could be a 30-15. So if you did that 30-15 first, you're not going to have an accurate assessment of body composition, or you're not going to have an accurate assessment of power. The reason being is because, well, you're so gassed that you can't reliably test for that characteristic. And you also can't accurately test for that physiological characteristic. So if you do a maximal aerobic test, you sure as hell ain't going to be as powerful 15 minutes later. So it's not only about kind of accurately, but you kind of got to be thinking about practicalities and feasibility. And so being able to select those tests in the right order will ensure that you're getting an accurate representation of your athlete's physical qualities. And then you can provide that information to your coach. If you do it in the wrong order, you're not going to be able to understand your athlete.
Fair enough. All right. You have a term, invisible monitoring. Would you elaborate on that?
Now, invisible monitoring is, I was really fortunate to be able to work with colleagues in the UK who are really good at this sort of stuff. I can mention of people like Cedric Leduc. And the concept was we would bring these athletes in kind of like hours for training just to be able to assess their fatigue and assess their changes in physical performance from the weekend. The issue is that if we have to bring them hours in advance just to do a counter movement jump or, you know, a groin squeeze or whatever it is to assess their fatigue, well, we're taking those hours away from their day, those hours where they could be recovering, they could be, you know, sleeping, they could be eating, they could be improving their performance. So it's quite counterintuitive. If you have a good understanding of technology and you have a good understanding of biomechanics and physiology, you can assess your athlete's performance without them knowing. So a good example of that is you might do a sprint session every week, most coaches probably do, where they hit certain high-speed meters. And we also know that with the micro-technology on their back, so things like the GPS units, which has certain micro-technology in the whole Magnum monitors, gyroscopes, GPS, and accelerometers. So that's why we call it micro-technology, not GPS units, because that's only one aspect. This technology can accurately detect, you know, the maximal sprint velocity or instantaneous velocity. So the thing is we can use that information to then assess our athletes' changes in performance over time. And if you can see they're just trending up, you can infer that their performance is improving. And the beautiful thing about that is you haven't had to go to a maximal sprint test and take out a whole day to go take their time and taking their time to test that physical quality, because you're getting them to hit maximal sprint speed in those sessions anyway. So we can use the technology that's on their back to monitor them invisibly. And there's a range of ways we can do it. Things like, you know, estimate 1RMs through monitoring velocity. Or we could do jump tests and pair that with other forms of, you know, strength testing to create dynamic strength indexes. We can use these sorts of underpinnings to better understand, those scientific underpinnings, to better understand our athletes so we can get a good understanding of them without them really knowing.
Okay, so now we have all this information, we record it in one way or the other. Now, would you have any tips on how to present this information to coaches and athletes?
Yeah, now this concept, like all of this stuff really just came from learnings from working with professional athletes. And this kind of angle, I will have to give an acknowledgement to Martin Boucher, because he was hugely influential in my career. When I was on the come up, he was just prolific, still is. And I remember him saying, the best time to get data in front of your coaches when they're coming out of the shower, because they can't escape, they can't run away, they're in a towel, man, they're vulnerable, get them. And I think there was a real good learning for me. The reason being is that coaches, you know, technical, tactical coaches, they don't love data like sports scientists do. But we love data. And the thing is that most people don't. And I think understanding that, we need to be really efficient and effective with our translation, dissemination of information to the coaches. Because if they don't have that information, why are you even doing it? It's pointless. So the thing is that we need to get that information to them effectively. And then when they're coming out of the showers, they can't run away, you know? So the thing is if we can get that graph or that figure or that information to them when they're not got 1,000 other things on their mind and they can just focus on you, you're doing a good job. But yeah, naturally, I think when we disseminate our information, it's got to be very, very efficient. The sooner that information gets to the coach, the better. Now, I'll give you an example of this. If we are monitoring fatigue through a counter movement jump and we test them before training and I get that information to them immediately before training, okay, the information is relatively useful. If I get it to them after training, kind of pointless, but it's still maybe useful because we can maybe change subsequent training sessions. If I get it to them next week, there's no point. There's absolutely no point. So it's all about efficiency. And that kind of concept comes from computer IT and kind of like data handling concepts with technology. The sooner information gets translated to an area, the more you can do with it. Those sorts of concepts are very, very important for also giving that information to coaches and table or graphics. We need to understand our audience. And coaches should have to use very low amounts of cognitive space to understand what we're trying to say. So if you cannot convey the information effectively, probably within 3 seconds, or the coach really has to kind of turn his head or rotate the page or flip it upside down or, you know, translate it from, you know, Spanish to English, and, you know, that information is pretty much pointless because they've only got probably 3 seconds and they probably don't want to even talk to us in the first place. They just want to talk to the players, right? And fair enough, I wouldn't want to talk to me either. Now, the thing is that I think what we need to then do is make sure coaches like the sort of way that we convey this information. So if they're a figure person, give them a figure. If they like data as in tables and they want to see every single number, cool, let's do it like that. But we need to know that. We need to make it easy for them. We need to be able to make sure the, you know, those little legends on the sides, let's turn them that way rather than vertical, because a coach doesn't have the time to cock their head 90 degrees. They're too busy. And that's right. They're earning the big bucks because their head's on the line at the end of the season if their athletes don't perform. So we need to make sure that that information is being conveyed to them in a very user-friendly way. Often we want to show the data. There's nothing worse than looking at a bar graph. You know, maybe it's just the academic in me and doing that PhD has kind of turned me a bit salty, but what does the bar graph tell you about athlete 8? I don't know. Or athlete 7 or athlete 12? I don't know. So you've got to show that data and how they change over time. You want to maybe integrate text into the figure to highlight key points and provide context where it's useful. You might also use color. Now, color is a funny one because color means something every single day. Color always means things. So if you've got red, why is it red? Why is it blue? If someone says something red, geez, I'm saying, oh, okay, danger, stop. You know, but why is it red? Is it dangerous? Oh, this athlete's in a bad place. Or blue, oh, but, you know, they're performing well. Green, go, great. I don't know. But whatever it is that you want to do, you want to declutter things and make it sure that they're not having to decipher 1,000 different things, including uncertainty. That's kind of to do with variability, noise, sensitivity. And then just using things like using space and sizes and shapes. Why are they triangles? Why are they squares? Why are they circles? You know, who's a circle? Isn't a circle an offensive player? Is a X a defensive player? I don't know. Up to you. But using these concepts to then understand and make pretty figures or pretty graphs or whatever it is that you want to do so that you can better convey your information to the coach, because your job is to get that information to coaches' hands, then help them make the right decisions. They're often not sports scientists, but your ability as a sports scientist is completely limited by an individual's, you know, understanding of your of sports science. So your ability to convey that information is essential.
So what I'm hearing is that less is more. So how little information can do the job in terms of communicating what you want the coach to know?
I don't know if less is more. I think better is more, you know? You know, more is not more, better is, you know, and I think if you can convey more information in shorter periods of time with less cognitive load, you're on top one.
Awesome. Thank you so much. 2 short questions to finish. The first one is, what is your favorite lift?
Man, I love a good pull-up. I love pull-ups, but I'm not a big guy. I'm not huge. So I'm probably coming in a good round 75 kilograms. So I think a pull-up reel, you know, separates the chaff from the wheat. And I think if there's little fellas like me.
Awesome. And the last question, where people can find you if they want to follow your work, see what you're up to, or ask a question?
Good point. I think emails, professional purposes, is always the way to go. And it's, you know, type in Jonathan Weekly Exercise and you'll get my email address easily. Probably the next thing would be things like Instagram. So Jonathan_Weekly_PhD. And yeah, I'm pretty responsive.
All right. Thank you so much, Jonathan. It was a pleasure.
Oh, cool. Good. Thank you so much.